Hello, Tom.
Hello.
This is Ron Kopnicki.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you a favor. When the meeting starts, could you let us know who the members of the committee are?
Mm-hmm. I just announced them.
Okay, so those are the members of the
yes.
committee.
Well, also Rebecca Wolf, but I don't know if she's gonna be here.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Okay, Jeff Baker's here. Now we're just waiting for Linda. But since this is recording, we can start at 6 without Linda. Okay, this is a meeting of the legal committee, which consists so far of Ryan Wallace, Jane Trombley, Dominic Moranti, John Rosenthal, and Rebecca Wolf. For those who may have forgotten how to behave on Zoom, the public will be invited to speak near the after we've discussed a number of things. Please raise your hand. And perhaps at some point, well, more importantly, I'm sure you all know by now that the governor has allowed us to go back to Zoom. Ooh. So that is why we are on Zoom. And that should be a reminder that whoever made that noise, please mute yourself if you're not one of the participants, the committee participants. Okay, Jeff, I was going to start with the just cause, but I'm waiting for someone who's... Oh, there she is. Rebecca Garrard, who's going to answer questions for us related to the just cause eviction proposed law. Committee members, I know you had questions. Jane, I think you had some questions about it, but you might.
Actually, Jane, do you mind if I jump in with a couple?
I was just going to suggest that I defer my time to Ryan, Tom, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Yield the floor.
Hi, Rebecca. It's nice to meet you. I hope it's safe. Oh, somebody can hear me. Thanks. I hope it stays sunny where you are right now. I think with the storm moving in, it you might end up running inside shortly here. So a couple of questions that I have.
I'm trying to avoid the noise of my children, so let's hope that doesn't happen, but glad to be here.
So the first question, and I'd love to hear from both you and Jeff Baker on this, is what's different in this bill that's not covered in New York State Real Property Actions and Proceedings Article 7?
Oh, a lot. There's a lot.
Can you elaborate beyond a lot, Jeff, too? Because
I can.
Between Article 7 and the 2019 Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act, there's quite a lot in there in terms of what we can be enforcing that actually affords a lot of protection to existing tenants in multiple situations, particularly those that are facing any illegal evictions. To a point where, you know, and I just want to make it clear for those that aren't familiar with the 2019 Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act, that actually reclassified a violation, which is assumably that a landlord could go in and throw a tenant out and pay a fine and be done with this person instead. And it's actually moved it up the ladder to a Class A misdemeanor where they can face arrest and charges. And I don't know if we are enforcing that currently with HPD, but Tom, it may be worth a discussion between the housing justice coordinator, the council, and the chief. And I only bring that up because there are attorney general materials that are available to local law enforcement in pushing that there. So going back to my original question, knowing that we have those two elements in place, what are we looking at to add and strengthen from there? Rebecca, I yield it to you.
Yeah, and Jeff, maybe if I can start and you can jump in after, does that feel okay?
Sure.
Yeah. So I guess I'll start with the second part of what you mentioned. You know, I spend a great deal of time in my work trying to educate municipalities around the fact that illegal evictions, which can look like shutting off utilities, harassing, there's a whole host of things, right? Changing keys are a misdemeanor as of 2019. And in fact, the AG's guidance to law enforcement, which was submitted to all law enforcement entities, right? It was not voluntary. That was given to them as guidance. Despite that fact, I think communities lack awareness of it and local law enforcement lacks awareness of it. And I can tell you that, you know, there was a case in Rensselaer County where I was able to successfully have a landlord charged with the misdemeanor. But when I first interfaced with the sheriff's office there, they literally had no idea what I was talking about. So it was political education to walk them through the process, right? What I will say to you, and let's use that case as an example, right? So I was successful. That landlord was charged with the misdemeanor. They had shut the power off in the winter because they were unable to evict a mom who had 3 children under the age of 4. And they had no heat because the power was off. So really egregious stuff, right? But it did nothing to stop the holdover eviction proceeding that the landlord was seeking, right? So the landlord was frustrated by the length of time that it was taking to move through that process and was annoyed that they had to afford the tenants the sort of due process that they have under the law. And that's what spurred these sort of actions. But the reality is it was a holdover eviction proceeding that this was centered around. And there is no protection against holdover eviction proceedings other than the only thing we wanted about that in 2019 was the length of time and the notice that you get for those was extended. So as I'm sure you know, but I will say for the benefit of others, if you live in an apartment in a unit for less than a year, you get 30 days. If it's a year up to 2 years, you get 60 days. If it's 2 years or longer, you get 90 days notice. That's the only thing we want on holdover evictions of 2019. If in case you're referring to the strengthening of prohibition against retaliatory evictions, which was ostensibly part of the 2019 package, which I worked very hard on. So I'm very well aware of what it has and what it's still lacking. there has yet, to my knowledge, to be one successfully, that defense to be successfully leveraged in an eviction case. And that's because the parameters are just too broad, right? So the good things it did was expand the people who could be committing the acts of retaliation beyond just the landlord, right? So it included property managers and other sorts of people responsible for properties when prior to 2019, it was very specifically only named the landlord. So that's a good thing it did. Yeah. But it still really only says that you can raise it as a defense. And if the landlord can give a hypothetical, right, reason that they might need the eviction that is not related to the complaints that were leveraged by the tenant, then that's not retaliatory, right? And so it really doesn't get to the heart of what this legislation does. And so I think I want to end with that, and then I'll pass it to Jeff. What this legislation really sets out to say is, if a tenant is fulfilling the obligations of their tenancy, right? Paying the rent on time, taking care of the property, not causing disruption to their neighbors, and there's a whole host of good causes, then they have the right to renew the tenancy, stay in the tenancy. And so there is nothing in that strengthening of the retaliation laws that prohibits a landlord from saying, I want to take back the property because I just want to, right? I want to not renew your lease because that's my choice. I don't have to give a reason for it. I'm entitled to do that under the law. from saying, you know, any reason, right? And so all we're saying is that any good, and I hate to use the word good, right? Any tenant who's fulfilling the obligations of their tenancy should be able to continue and maintain their tenancy. The other piece of what this does that is not touched anywhere in any piece of legislation, right, whether strengthened or not, is the requirement of justification for a rent increase above a certain threshold. And so for doing nothing, and forgive me one second, my battery is running.
Did we lose her? I don't know if she's frozen now. I think we might have.
She does look frozen.
All right, Jeff, do you want to jump in? Because the one thing I will say, and I'll ask her too, I mean, like in the case of the holdover, right? I mean, and for those that don't know, the holdover is meaning that the lease term is expired, the tenant still paid rent and continues to remain within the premises or the property. Under Article 7, they are guaranteed to a day in court already. So if that's where she was going about the representational element of that, that's already protected by New York State in that element.
And I so am back, left. Ryan. I'm sorry.
There we go. No yeah. worries.
Technology. I'm on my phone, so we should be good now. Could you just repeat what you had said? So
I said while we were losing you because you were saying what the bill was hoping, what's not in there, and you froze. But going back really quickly to what you were saying about the holdover example. There is sufficient protections within Article 7 already. If they are in, you know, good standing, the burden of proof to prove that the tenant needs to be removed is on the landlord in that case under existing Article 7.
I just couldn't disagree more. So let's walk through this scenario and maybe we'll come to alignment.
Let me interrupt a bit, if I will, because I don't think we need to get into that detail. What the just cause eviction law does, which is what Rebecca was just talking about, is covers an area of things that I don't believe is covered at all under Article 7 of the real property laws. It does build in essentially a presumption that a tenant that is in compliance with their lease terms will be given an opportunity to re-up their lease. And it's written sort of in a backwards way, but if the tenant has fallen behind on their rent, it is up to the landlord to show that that rent has not been increased in recent years. And it's written kind of funny because it can cover more than 1 year in an unconscionable manner. And it is
did we lose Jeff too?
That if the rent is increased, it is unconscionable.
Jeff, can you repeat that last part? You froze on us for a second.
I'm sorry. There's a rebuttable presumption in there that if the rent has increased more than 5% a year, it is unconscionable, and the tenant cannot be evicted for failing to pay that increased rent. The court, in determining whether something is unconscionable, where there is essentially good cause for the landlord to proceed with the eviction, takes a variety of factors into account, including the rate of the increase relative to the tenant's ability to pay, what improvements were made to the unit or the common area by the landlord, whether the increase was a retaliation for the tenant exercising their rights to complain under the real property law, whether there are significant market changes relevant to the unit, the condition of the unit, and the common areas. So, you know, this trick, this kicks in the manner of the landlord has increased your rent. Or let me just back it up. The tenant is not paying their rent. The landlord starts an eviction proceeding. It is the burden on the landlord to show that it was good cause, and taking into those effects is that essentially the rent has not been increased in a manner that is unfair to the tenant. And those are the factors that get taken into account, you know, that I just indicated. Now, they can also, there are, as I think Rebecca was starting to get into, other grounds, you know, other just cause evictions. The tenant is a nuisance. The tenant is violating a substantial term of the tenancy. The occupation causes a violation of law. That's sort of an issue of the code questions and the compliance of the apartment. But there are provisions in there to protect people from being evicted because of that. Using the premises for illegal purposes. The tenant unreasonably refuses access for repairs, improvements, or showing the building to a prospective purchaser. And then there's some other ones that are, you know, interesting. For a building with less than 12 units, the landlord seeks possession of one of the units because of an immediate and compelling necessity for use by a family member. So, you know, you're the landlord and say, I need one of those apartments for my family members. And family members includes in-laws. Yeah. Under the way it's written, but they couldn't exercise that on a tenant who is 62 or older or disabled. In a building with less than 5 units, the landlord could take possession if he wants to use any of all to personally occupy for himself for a principal residence. Another exception, if there is a good faith contract of sale to deliver the building tenant free to a third party purchaser, and there is no financial or personal connection between the seller and the buyer, that's another exemption from this. And then there's another very interesting one that if the landlord gives good faith notice to the tenant at least 5 months before the lease is up of their intent not to renew it, and the landlord and the tenant consents to that, and it has to be informed consent in terms of the landlord has to provide notice as to what the rights are of the tenant. And then the landlord has a signed lease with a new tenant, that's good cause for eviction. And then, so those are the all the elements for good cause that could be done. The from the draft that was originally circulated, I was working from an earlier draft that Albany did. Albany's final draft added some other provisions. For instance, they exempted buildings with less than 4 units if one of them is owner-occupied. So, for instance, if you own a duplex and you live on one side, this doesn't
pertain to you.
No, Jeff.
And saying freeze again.
Yeah. If you live in a duplex, this doesn't pertain to you.
Right. It also exempts sublessors, excuse me, who want to regain possession. I'm sorry, I'm going to try and fix this.
That's okay.
And I'm not. And it doesn't apply to premises tied to employment where you've been fired for, you know, legal reasons. And then it doesn't apply if you're under some kind of rent control or subject to other federal rules or whatever. So the point is there's a lot of exemptions to this on how it's provided, but it does cover, you know, going to your first question, Ryan, I think a whole area of presumptions that are different from existing law. But that's also why this raises questions. This is, maybe Rebecca knows better, this is the first time Albany is the first city who's ever tried to do this. They've been threatened with a lawsuit by landlords groups. They have not been sued yet. The statute of limitations on that, depending on what the claim is, still has a long way to go. There's some potential infirmities in how the law was filed as to whether it's even in effect now. Anyway, that's, you know, I think, you know, one of the questions about this is this a kind of a backdoor way to do rent control?
Correct.
Which is not following the state law that provided, you know, the mechanisms for cities to do rent control. I mean, it isn't the same as rent control, but it has some similarities to it. And that's why there's going to be a legal challenge. There could be a legal challenge.
Correct.
And I do see that Jane had her hand up. I mean, obviously, I defer to all of you and appreciate being here to answer questions. I think it would be helpful if maybe I could answer some of the questions before we go to another person for more questions, because they might just sort of pile up.
If that feels comfortable. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I really actually do want to go back to a point Ryan was making when Jeff stepped back in about Section 7 of RPAPL. So I'm good friends with the people that wrote the statewide good cause bill, two attorneys, and they are also the people who drafted the 2019, what became, right, the HSTPA, the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act, and are the people who appear in federal court and, you know, write amicus briefs, right, on all the housing legislation that is in New York. They were the authors of good cause legislation entirely because there is nothing in any place in Article 7 of RPAPL that provides the service this good cause eviction legislation does. There is nothing, even if a tenant does get a day in court, that gives the tenant the right to fight a landlord not renewing their lease. So they have a right to fight an eviction mid-lease, but at lease renewal, there is absolutely nothing in Article 7 that gives the tenant the right to stay in that tenancy at the end of a lease. There's nothing that compels a landlord to renew it. And when we talk about month-to-month tenancies, the same applies. There is no legal standing for a tenant to extend their month-to-month tenancies, even if they're fulfilling the obligations of their tenancy. That does not exist in Article 7 of RPAPL. And so that is a vital function of this, and one which I really wanted to come back to, because we must recognize that. We really must. Two, I think I'll sort of start with the beginning, now I'll start with the end. In terms of what Jeff was describing, and I think I'm glad we ended on that sort of really false idea that this is a back end into rent control, that we do hear a lot, right? And we certainly heard it in Albany. You know, this is the answer I always give. I should be so lucky. I should be so lucky that this is rent control. The reality is that rent regulation is a system that is monitored by the state. In these situations, right, would the rent increases are set by a rent guidelines board at the county level, right? They don't take individual landlords into account. And if increases need to go beyond that because of cost increases, right, you have to apply to HCR to get that MCI, that IAI, right? So it's very landlord, the responsibility falls all on the landlord in a rent regulation system, right? And then there's the inherent good cause where you have to prove affirmatively, right, that there is a cause for eviction. In this case, all it does is give a tenant an affirmative defense in a court situation. So a landlord can file an eviction, right? And pick, you know, have to name a cause, and the tenant will have to try to assert that they didn't meet that cause. But most importantly, because what people hate about rent regulation is actually not the good cause protections, right? It's the increase, right? It's just what Jeff laid out. So if I'm a landlord, right, and this passes, and I want to raise my tenant's rent 10% because I had to replace the boiler or the roof, right? If this was rent regulation, I'd have to apply to the state and get that approved. In this case, you simply raise the rent 10%, right? The tenant can then choose to pay it. Or if they believe that the increase was unreasonable, right, and not related to a cost associated with the building, they could choose to pay their rent and the 5% increase that's allowed without any proof of cost increase. The landlord could initiate a non-payment eviction. And then the tenant would have an affirmative defense against that non-payment to say, that 5% that I'm not paying, I believe was an unreasonable increase. And I'm asking the landlord to prove that there was a cost association with it. If the landlord could prove it, the tenant could pay their balance back and everybody moves forward. If the landlord could not prove it, then that would be a dismissed case, right? And that amount between what was allowed without proof and what's not allowed with proof. But all it does is give a tenant an affirmative defense in a non-payment eviction. The burden is wholly on the tenant. And I really want to, I think sometimes we get stuck in this mind that like tenants are going to, I should be so lucky here too, right? Tenants are going to find out they have these rights and assert them in these wild ways, right? What do we know about Hudson?
You're getting to the heart of my argument in general, which is that it's like tenants are so underrepresented to begin with. I mean, it's like 90% of landlords will show up into court with an attorney. 10% maybe of tenants do, because it's unlike Miranda law, right? Which people know you've got a right to a defense. You do as well in civil court, but that's not really as advertised or as well known.
I mean, I think the lack of representation is not a reason to not give tenants rights. It's a reason to pass like right to counsel legislation, which is another thing we're fighting for, you know, but I would think that poor implementation on the part of the state and municipalities is no justification for not increasing much needed rights among a certain population.
Can I just jump in for a minute? I just want to make something clear. I'm not taking any position on this, that this is a bad policy or that this isn't a good thing. I mean, I do think it is, the intent here is very good. I'm looking at it, and one of my concerns strictly on a legal position, right, is whether under municipal home rule, a city can do this where you have a state system that generally covers the field. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
I know that. Let me just finish. I mean, that's part of the question is, you know, does Hudson even have the authority to do this before we figure out the details about how we want to do that? That's one thing. And then the other question that I think, you know, Ryan, you're pointing to, and certainly Rebecca did, which is, you know, access to counsel.
Correct.
Is a whole different issue. And, you know, as an aside on this, I met today with the Legal Aid Society in Albany, and their lawyers who cover Columbia County, you know, are willing and able to provide more assistance to any tenants in Hudson and Columbia County, they said, but we were focusing just on Hudson to, you know, to the extent there's a problem of a lack of access to, you know, to counsel, there is access available, and something that we should be strengthening the ties between tenants groups in the city and the Legal Aid Society.
I couldn't agree more. And actually, the two attorneys that I referred to, sorry, Jane, I will, but, and this is just important. The two attorneys that I referred to actually work for Legal Aid Society in New York City. They are not practicing attorneys in the field at this point. They are much higher up in the organization. The reason they actually drafted the good cause legislation is because they have right to counsel in New York City. And what they heard from their practitioners is that when we are representing unregulated tenants, we don't have laws on the books that allow us to keep them in their homes. And so right to counsel is extremely useful for our regulated tenants, but for our unregulated tenants, we need a law that allows us to assert some right to keep them in place. And that was actually the whole onus of this law being drafted.
Jane, you've been waiting patiently.
Thank you, Tom. So we've gotten into a very detailed legal discussion this evening, and it's been informative. And thank you, Rebecca, for lending your expertise and the background you have on this subject matter.
Oh, hold on one second. Rebecca, could you let everybody know who you represent? Because I'm not sure we made that clear at the beginning.
Yeah, certainly. I am the legislative director for Citizen Action of New York, and I sit on the steering committee of Housing Justice for All.
Sorry, Jane. Continue, please.
Okay. So I think really at issue, there's a ton to consider and there's a ton to unpack in terms of representation and the topics that we've been discussing. My questions, though, have to do with specifically the way this is written, and I'm looking at the draft that was distributed at earlier, I guess, a month ago. And I have two specific questions about the way this is written and the language that's used. And number one is grounds for removal of tenants, Article 3, subsection 1. We're talking about the rate of increase relative to the tenant's ability to afford said increase. And I don't understand, this seems vague to me. I don't understand why it was written in such a way that there's the question of accountability comes up. Somebody says, the way I interpret this, somebody says, a tenant says, I don't have the ability to pay. I'm sorry, I don't. But there's no language in here that would necessitate any documentation on ability to pay. If a rent increase is presented and they say, oh, geez, I can't make that. I would think further documentation, further, I hate to use the word proof, but further acknowledgement or support for that statement would be required. That's number one. Number two, well, actually, it's within this paragraph, and maybe I would appreciate clarification if I'm not interpreting this correctly, but unconscionable or imposed for the purpose of circumventing the intent this article, if said rent has been increased in any calendar year by a percentage exceeding 5%. We've just talked about the 5% rule. Rebecca touched on it a minute ago. It seems like a 5% increase is actually a rather strict cap if it isn't to exceed 5%. If one's rent is $1,000, 5% $50. And I'm going to go back to my earlier point of not documenting the need that $50 is onerous. Certainly in many cases it is. It's a make or break number. But if we're enacting this legislation, and this is pretty sweeping, and Jeff has suggested that there's a home rule question, I submit that it should be tighter, that the relief of this is documented in a way that we really understand that it's need and not taking somebody's word for it. Because 5% is a big cap. Or we raise this, I'll call it a cap, and that the increase is greater than 5%. Because 5%, I mean, whether the boiler breaks or not, 5% is not very much money on a theoretical $1,000 a month apartment.
Just one thing on that, Jane. I mean, I certainly understand your point. I think it is implicit or in the law, whatever, that for all of the elements that is either getting proved by the landlord or defended affirmative defense by the tenant, they're going to require competent evidence, admissible evidence on the court. You know, a tenant coming in and saying, I can't afford this anymore. this is way too high. It's gone up, you know, beyond my means. The 5% is still unfair for me. There have been no improvements to the building that warrant this increase, and I can't afford it. It would be incumbent upon the tenant to demonstrate that. I mean, it does raise the question of, you know, is a landlord on the hook if the tenant has, you know, lost their job or changed their jobs or had a change in their income status or something like that? And I identified that as a question, too. I'm not sure how that practically gets applied.
Yeah.
But generally, I think you can assume any time when they're saying, you know, one of these elements have to be done, there would have to be, you know, real evidence admissible in court.
Right, but that's not what this law says.
Yeah, if I
well, but you know, I don't think you have to say that for every law. I mean, that's sort of whenever you're doing trying to prove something. But we certainly, if we're going to go forward with this, we could add language to clarify that.
I thank you. There are two points here that I think are just they don't compute to me, and I think that what you say, Jeff, is exactly right. But I would like to see it far more detailed in this. In this language before this could be, before this passes muster.
I do want to explain because I did.
Rebecca, please. You really yes, have for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you have an explanation, but the exceeding the 5%, I think also is onerous. I think a 5% seems to me to be an arbitrary amount. I don't understand the rationale behind 5% other than it's not very much. And could there, I posit that there could be a sliding scale. If the rent is at X level, then maybe it's 5%. If it's below that threshold, there's an increase that could be greater. I'm tossing that out as an idea. I have no idea if that's workable. But it does seem that this is a very cut and dried, the way this is written, it's very, very cut and dried. It is very, very definitive. And I think that the language needs to be revisited. That's off. Hand it over to you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. And certainly did not mean to stop you mid comment. So I think for the first part, and I did work with Albany on this, the first part was actually had the intent of being friendly actually to the landlord population, right? So if you take that first clause out that talks about is there need, it really is much more ironclad, right? Where it says the tenant, you know, like you, they have failed to pay rent and in determining whether it's owed, if we just skip to two, right? That the landlord has to say improvements are made subject to the unit. whether the increase was precipitated by some behavior of the blah, 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 right? But I think the attempt actually of number one was to try to say that if this is a luxury building, right, and there are luxury buildings going on around and rents are increasing, but this increase does not seem to be one which impacts an extremely high income tenant who can easily afford it, that is a factor that can be considered. So the intent of that was actually the opposite of the way you're reading it, but I also think I would agree that it's fine to take it out, right? But just wanted to explain the background and intent of that was actually to give judges discretion to allow for increases beyond 5% in really, really wealthy populations, which is not what this bill was really attempting to stabilize, right? So that was the intent of the inclusion of that
clause. Okay, I think as we consider passage of this and we work it through, I think we've got to be far more specific in our language. We have to be far more specific in a ratio between rent and, you know, housing burdenness, if you will. I don't know if that's a legal term. A relationship between one's income and one's rent, because to your point, this is kind of across the board. This could apply to wealthy tenants and high luxury buildings. So if we're writing this to protect the people who are in the greatest need of protection and oversight, then I think
this is the place to say it. And
yeah, and to your second point, I think it's vitally important to have the cap, right? And then I think judicial discretion to say, okay, right, I'm not going to impose this on this really wealthy luxury tenant, but I'm going to explain why. And I think, again, Hudson is the perfect example. There is a domino effect of every rent increase on every unit that happens in your city. So it is not just about the one tenant in the unit who maybe could afford a 10%, right? You may say 5% doesn't feel like a lot. I assert to you that real estate is the most profitable industry in New York, and at 5%, it will still be highly profitable. So if we're going to start saying, well, this person in this unit has a very high income, they could afford a 15% rent with no cost justification. The reality is the market, the way the market works, is that every other unit follows suit. This is why we have to be so careful when we bring in new development, because it is not just about what those rents are set out in those buildings. The ripple effect on every other unit is what has caused the crisis that exists in Hudson and many other cities across the state right now. And so you cannot look at it into this individualized manner. You must look at it in a systemic manner. It is the only way we are not going to ensure that every single person who's lived in Hudson for generations no longer has a place to live there. To be quite blunt, that is the situation you're all in.
There certainly is an argument for that, but I think that it is putting a burden of housing issues and housing crisis on Hudson that is a national issue. So I have a real, I take your point, but I think that we can't look at Hudson and say we're going to build this fence around Hudson and we're going to create a society or a housing market that is absolutely, you know, ironclad and is going to protect those that need to be protected and is going to ensure people who have lived here can continue to live here because they're going to have these rules and not be cognizant of what's going on around us within the county, within the state, within the region, within the area. It's unrealistic. So I think we need to be very, very careful that we don't kind of back into rent control. We don't back into situations that are unfair to one income level of tenant and very fair to another. I mean, however that balance is struck. I also think that there's only so much realistically that the city of Hudson can do to avert or to mitigate a housing issue through rent stabilization, rent control, rent, you know.
This is not, let's be clear, which this is 100% not.
Okay. We may have to agree to disagree on
No, really isn't by definition. There's nothing to agree to disagree on that. By definition, it is not. So we can have different opinions, but we must acknowledge the facts. This is not rent control. It is not close to rent control. That is a fact.
Okay. Thank you, Rebecca.
Hold on a second.
It seems like exceeding 5% sounds like a different version of it, but...
So an affirmative defense that China has in court, a rent regulation system, is rent control. Those are vastly different things, and I think I laid that out before. Again, I'm open to different opinions, but I really do want this conversation to be stay centered and
we'll stay centered to the topic at hand and to the piece of legislation. I think that's something we certainly can agree on. We're talking about this.
To your issue of whether we would be trying to solve the housing crisis on our own, it should be pointed out that Albany has already approved this law. So it's not quite us leading in that respect.
The state law that Albany has...
No, this very law that we're looking at.
Our very law?
Yeah, the one...
Our draft law?
I'm sorry, what are you asking?
I'm not following you.
The law that we're considering has already been passed by Albany.
Yes.
Okay.
With the changes I noted.
Yeah, with the changes noted by Jeff. Okay. So we would not
You should all know it's been introduced in multiple other... It was introduced in Kingston, Ulster County, actually stronger versions than the one you're considering, ones that don't allow for a good cause to be a transfer of ownership.
Well, correct, Rebecca?
Say it again?
Newburgh as well, I think.
Newburgh, Poughkeepsie, Beacon, Ithaca, New Paltz. So we have about 13 active campaigns going on. In Syracuse, the legislation went to the city council this week. Rochester.
Okay. Thank you, Rebecca. Committee members, any other questions or comments from committee first? Okay.
No, I have a comment.
Well, hold on, Tiffany. Claire was ahead of you. Claire, would you like to?
Are we still within the committee, Tom?
Yes. Well, no.
So
what do you mean?
The other committee person that hasn't maybe chimed in is John Rosenthal.
Well, I'm not going to force him to speak.
Well, I mean, I'm listening. I'm also very curious about, you know, whatever changes we do make to the current bill, if it passes, and I think something like this should pass, how does it work in effect? I mean, how's this going to work on the ground here? How much difference is it going to make immediately for tenants who are rent stressed, et cetera, in terms of their, how are we going to make it function?
I think Rebecca Wolf has just joined us, and I think she can address that because we do have a new fair housing officer among other entities that could probably handle this.
Right, I mean, because it seems like there's going to be a lot of coordination between getting tenants to representation and getting them in front of, like, making sure that they show up in court, they understand how the law works. It seems like it's a potential for a lot of cost on us as well. So I'm just curious about the enforceability side of it.
Legal aid
actually. That's right.
True.
And Malachi's correct there, John. I mean, just the Legal Aid Society actually will represent and help a lot of the low, especially low income residents.
Well, I'm aware of that. So I've just, again, a lot of that, you know, I just want this, if we pass this, I want it to be effective and not something that essentially is something we pass that then sort of floats around and doesn't really provide real relief to tenants.
Yeah, just to, also, add that, yes, the Fair Housing Officer is a resource for tenants to connect them with legal representation. So that's part of what that role is for.
And that's Michelle, right, Rebecca?
Nope.
That's else.
Teresa Joyner.
Michelle is the Housing Justice Director, which is a city position. Teresa Joyner is a full-time job. Housing Justice Director is a full-time position. Fair Housing Officer is a very part-time position that is Teresa Joyner.
Right.
Yep.
And Michelle's role is the one that's funded by your very hard-won grant.
Indeed. Well, it starts out being like there's, it is funded by the grant. The expectation is that there will be increasing funding from external resources, revenue streams, through the housing fund
to keep it going.
Yep.
Okay, so I had Claire on tap next. So Claire, would you like to speak?
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. When listening to some of the comments from committee members, you guys are elected officials, you know, my regular, this is what I tend to remind people of, not like they don't already know, but people elect you to follow the trends, to fight the national crisis. The things sitting before you is not something that was created out of thin air. This is something that is being looked at across the state and is successful so far across the state, and it's something that we are asking Hudson to follow in the footsteps of other places across New York State and do the right thing, because this is a national crisis. And when we say things like a tenant has to prove that with very little to no change to their living condition, they can't afford a rent increase, is only speaking to the fact that's literally perpetuating the affordable housing crisis. That's saying that being able to raise the rent without a reasonable or just cause, and then having a tenant who agreed to a certain rent and isn't getting a better quality of life has to pay more. That is what created the housing crisis. And you absolutely, as an elected official, have the power to change that narrative for not just one demographic of people, but for a spectrum of people who are fighting this affordable housing crisis, from as low as subsidized housing to working class and everybody in between, because finding something affordable is almost impossible in Hudson. There's a two-bedroom listed in Hudson for $2,300. There's nothing affordable about that for somebody that holds three jobs. That's intense. And when you have legislation in front of you that was passed in other cities across New York State, there's nothing unconventional about this. I think that it's important to have the conversations. I'm thankful that Rebecca Gerard is here to give the facts that oftentimes people on the Common Council say advocates are lacking, even though this is somebody that we work hand in hand with. This is somebody that we get much of our information from, almost all of our information from. These are the national advocates that we follow, and we show up to these meetings and dedicate our time to help educate you on the trends of the nation and what's happening across the state also. So I think that I resent some of the comments that have been made. This is about the affordable housing crisis. The crisis will only increase when tenants are able to be evicted and when they have to get in front of a judge and prove without resources. I really do urge our elected officials to think about everybody that is encompassed in the word affordable housing. Affordable housing is not just subsidized housing. There are so many people affected by the things that you are saying. And I think that you need to look at what other cities have done so far and do a little bit of research to support your constituents at this point.
I 100% co-sign with Claire.
Thank you, Claire and Malachi. I want to point out that in the beginning I announced the members of this committee. Apparently, Tiffany Garrigo is a member of this committee. We're not, you know, putting number limits on how many members there can be in a committee anymore. So I will get to Anthony D'Argenzio shortly, but Tiffany, as a committee member, you are up next.
Thank you, Tom. Claire, and thank you for that clarification. You know, when I was younger, we would say out of the mouths of babes, and sometimes it takes the younger generation to teach the older generation to actually understand and see what's going on. Especially as an elected official, it's crucial to know what's going on in your surroundings, your constituents, their situations. And I would say, yes, 100%, Hudson needs to be an example, because we're hurting so bad here in such a small community. We're hurting to the point where we are losing our population. And you don't see that as a crisis, as a need? That just baffles me. And, you know, being a part of a housing organization, you know, we hear the needs every single day. And it's not just about not paying your rent or not being able to afford the rent. You have landlords out here that take advantage of their tenants. This law helps in so many ways to protect both, but mainly the tenants. There's so many people here tonight, and I'm glad to see this, because I wish that Hudson was the first city to implement this law, to be that leadership that I know that we can be. I stand by this law. When the time comes to vote on this law, I hope the council comes to that conclusion of what is needed and talk to your constituents. And if it's just, and as elected officials, we represent the entire city. So talk to your non-constituents, find out what's going on. Talk to social services. Talk to the waiting list of housing that is needed here. I mean, it's so serious. It's a crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany. Now, patiently waiting is Anthony D'Argenzio. Are you there? Hello? You're muted.
Their hand just went down. I don't know if that was...
Okay. If that's...
I'm so sorry, because I know I've taken up so much space.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Just one other really factual point that I think is really good for folks to know, too, because we keep talking about the difference between rent control or rent stabilization in this. One other key difference that hasn't been mentioned is that in rent stabilization, often referred to as rent control, when the rent is set, that rent exists from tenancy to tenancy. So when a tenant moves out, that rent stays the same, and whomever moves in after that, that is the rent that's allowed, right, to be charged for that apartment in a rent regulation system. With good cause, these increases only exist attached to the current tenant. And so when a tenant moves, that landlord is allowed to reset that rent to whatever they want. It is a very big difference, and one that I really thought, you know, couldn't go unmentioned when we talk about this.
I was having technical difficulties and I couldn't untap the unmute. I'm sorry about that. If I could have a quick moment, this is Anthony.
Okay.
I think this is a really important topic, and we definitely need some protection for all the housing members and everyone that wants to live in this town. And I had some couple questions regarding the 5% that you guys were discussing. And I think maybe there could be some additional parameters around this. I mean, landlords specifically have costs that change, especially with the increase of taxes, the operating expenses related to the building. If maybe some of that stuff could be accounted for as well in this law?
I think it is.
Yep, it's listed explicitly as, yep.
So what is the 5%? Can you explain a little bit more about the 5% element?
I don't know if that's me, but I'll take a stab at it. So the 5% is an increase that can exist with no cost justification whatsoever. So you could have no cost change associated with your building. In fact, you could have a cost decrease, right? Sometimes when we do tax, assessments, right? Sometimes people actually have taxes that go down. Sadly, sometimes they also go up, but I'm just saying, right? Like, costs do ebb and flow on properties. Maybe somebody pays off a mortgage, right? Maybe they had a mortgage on a property and all of a sudden their costs have dramatically decreased, right? None of that matters. 5% is an increase that you get to enact on an annual basis without any justification of cost. What that metric is it says if you're going to go above repeated annual increases to 5%, right? Let me be clear too, right? And I've said this to folks too. I would be hard pressed to find any tenant who's gonna not pay a 10% increase. I wish, but right, in order to force a non-payment eviction so that they can raise an affirmative defense in court over the 5% difference and ask for justification of it. What we see and what this really aims to address, right? We see 50% increases on properties in a year that are not associated with cost, right? They're associated with a new development that was next door. And so now all of a sudden they're charging 200% of what I charge.
But it's a three-unit building and there's a reassessment and it goes up 50%.
Well, that's covered.
Again, that's covered. I'm talking about the increases that literally happen because of proximity to development, not because of development or cost increase, proximity, because of price gouging, because the fact is that people are so desperate for housing, they will pay anything because they have to pay anything.
And we're talking about landlords who use those sorts of practices when they're setting their pricing scales. But if your property went up so dramatically that you needed that sort of a dramatic increase, right, and that does happen, then that's covered under the legislation.
Thank you. And you have to prove that?
Yes.
Okay.
So again, actually, you don't, right? The tenant, has to prove
sorry.
It. This is why this is not rent control. You can simply say to the tenant, I'm raising your rent 50%. Let's assume it's $1,000 rent. You can say, okay, your rent is now $1,500. You would have to follow the notice that you need to give to people, which was defined under the 2019 HSTPA. There are notice requirements for that, right? So following the notice rules, depending on how long they've lived there, you can simply say, next month, your rent is going from $1,000 to $1,500. Nothing, you don't have to prove anything. The tenant will then have to choose, do I think that there's a cost justification for this? And if there is, they'll know they'll lose in court, right? So why would a tenant not pay the extra increase to force it in you into a non-payment eviction, to then go to court to justify the increase, only to owe it anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, most tenants I know would say, like, that's really high. Was there a reason for that? And, like, if you're a good landlord, then you're like, I'm dying here, right? Like, the assessment just came through. Like, I don't know how many, like, a tenant is not going to force that situation. But you wouldn't have to do anything other than just increase it. All the responsibility falls on the tenant to choose not to pay it if they think that this was predatory and not cost related, which would mean that the landlord initiates a non-payment eviction, and then they would have an affirmative defense in court against that non-payment eviction to say, well, I didn't pay it because I don't think there was a cost justification for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Rebecca.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move on. Thank you, Rebecca, for coming tonight. I appreciate all the comments. Oh, wait. I see one more. Kathleen
Anderson.
Thank you, Ryan. I can. Kathleen, unmute yourself and identify yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Kat Anderson. I grew up in Hudson, graduated from Hudson High School. I currently live across the river, but I work as the Tenants' Rights Hotline Coordinator for Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition.
Okay.
I just wanted to echo what Rebecca said and say that from my personal observations, I don't find the 5% cap to be particularly tight or arbitrary. You know, as Rebecca referenced in the 2019 rent reform, the notice requirements were set at 5%. And I'd also like to point out that for mobile home regulations in New York State, rent increases for lot fees are set at 3%, which is far lower than the 5% here. So I just wanted to point that out for the record.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move along.
Tom, I just wanted to point out, Michelle had her hand up. I don't know
Who?
If she had her virtual hand or just her real hand.
Who?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh.
Just real quick, I don't know whose question directed to, maybe Jeff, but...
Michelle, will you tell people who you are, please?
Oh, hi. Yes. I'm Michelle Tulo. I'm the Housing Justice Director. And I was wondering, so one good cause of eviction in this legislation is if market conditions, it says that's a reason to evict tenants, but market conditions are the reason why the rents have been going up so much. So to me, that feels like a huge loophole that takes the teeth out of this legislation. And I was wondering if any thoughts on that.
And same question. I don't know if Rebecca had any experience. I think that
Did you hear that?
Yeah, that's in the Albany law. I just followed it. And I'm not sure what it means or how it applies, because it would seem to be that if the market's going up in the neighborhood, they're being improved, you could do it.
Are we referring to which section? Can you just tell me which section?
Yeah, it's in section one.
A1?
Yeah, it's A1. Sub 4.
I would love for that and one to come out, right? Like, so the onus, as I sort of said before with Jane, the onus of
of those was actually not to be tenant friendly. It was to be landlord friendly. It was exactly the opposite. So I would be highly supportive of those really subjective metrics coming out. I think something that's very quantifiable and measurable is the best way to ensure that we have just implementation of legislation. Discretion is a very dangerous thing, right? When we're talking about laws being implemented. And so I would be fully supportive of both of those sections and agree with Michelle. The market and how it impacts housing prices is exactly why we're here.
Thank you. Rebecca, you have some, Rebecca Wolf.
I just wanted to, support that. Okay. To me, it seems like this is sort of the subtext of this whole effort is to try to push back against market forces, which are making it impossible for people to find a place to live. And when I say people, I mean people who don't make, the kind of money that are at the top of the market. So I think that that's something that needs to be confronted head on with this and really spoken about because, I'll just say I grew up in a rent controlled apartment in Manhattan. The Manhattan that I grew up in had space in it for a huge range of economic and social, demographic. It was way cooler than what you see now in Manhattan. And I think that it's really important, like what Tiffany was saying, that the city of Hudson really, contemplate how it wants to try to support the actual diversity of socioeconomic presence here in the city, which do make it what it is. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rebecca. We got to move along because we have a couple of other topics to cover here tonight.
Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you, Rebecca Gard, and everybody else who is here for that discussion. We have one thing we can talk about quickly, I believe, is the other law that's on our desk, which has to do with rezoning the R4 district. Turns out what we're going to end up being able to do instead is revisiting a law that was passed in 2017 but seems to have identified the wrong district. Is that right, Jeff? Does that concur with what we've... I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, my connection was bad. Can you just repeat that?
Oh, that the law that was passed in 2017 allowing a certain eating and drinking establishments with a lot of...
I don't think they ever passed it, Tom.
Yes, you did.
They did pass it. Really? Yes, they did. Yeah. 2017.
The one that Steve, just real quickly, Steve Dunn's.
Yes, it was passed. Yeah. It was passed in 2017. The problem.
No, 2018. The Steve Dunn law, as far as I can tell, was not adopted, but a very similar one with some different provisions was adopted in 2018.
And Jeff, isn't the problem that it speaks to the R2 district and not the R4 district?
Right.
Well, could Jeff, could I just ask a question quickly? Steve's law that we never really bothered to go forward with, would that seem to address this? Although I know they're overlapping between one that we passed, which I didn't realize we passed it. But if that is a better fix than the 2017 one that Tom's talking about.
No, not necessarily. I mean, what basically happened, if you look at, and I think I had the draft of Steve's law in front of me now.
Yeah, I sent it to you.
We amended 325-8, which is for the R2. Steve's language included essentially what is now sub-4 of that section B4. And I think the law in 2018 also added another provision, sub-5, which isn't really relevant to what we're talking about. But anyway, there is a law in the books that says with respect to any building or portion thereof, the use of which is currently a non-conforming use or was a non-conforming use. I did not subsequently.
Yep, Jeff froze.
Freezing Jeff.
Lease uses are.
John, you're getting a lot of feedback too, John.
Jeff, could you do it again?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know my connection isn't good. And I can't fix that, unfortunately. What it says is, with respect to any building or portion thereof, the use of which is currently a non-conforming use or was a non-conforming use, it did not subsequently become a dwelling unit, then it can be subject to a conditional use permit by the planning board, be permitted to be a restaurant, offices, or whatever.
And this,
And we can take that language and probably make some changes to it, as I just realized, or something, but and have it apply in the R4 also.
And now, that,
I had a first, I had a fundamental factual question. I don't know if Tiffany knows this or somebody does. Has that building been converted to a residential use at all?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, good, good. And Ryan, I think you had a good point when we talked about this last time, is given the structure of our law, by putting this into the R4, how many other districts will this apply to? Correct. And I went back and I compared that, and it actually won't. The only one it would also apply to is the RSC and the RSC2. But they already permit all of these uses, so it wouldn't have any material effect on that.
RSC is like Dock Street. RSC2 is...
I didn't pull up the map on that, but yeah.
Jane, I want to point out, this speaks to your concern that a residential building could be converted to a eating and drinking establishment. This would not allow for that. You're muted, by the way.
Sorry, there was a lot of feedback, so I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I said the way this law, as we're revising it, speaks to your concern, because it has to have, it can't be an existing residential building being changed to a drinking or eating establishment.
Yeah, thank you. And that speaks to my concern about that and about sort of the neighborhood cohesiveness. Right.
Okay, so Tiffany, we're very close to getting Basil Nooks in business.
Very good.
So just for clarity, you want me to draft a law along that line to incorporate that into the R4?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Also on tonight is, inclusionary zoning.
I think, in terms of what's imperative for the city and where we are, is talk about the sidewalk law.
Oh, sorry. Okay. We'll go that first.
Because there's... Let me pull up my notes.
While you're doing that, Tiffany, is there something you wanted to say? Oh, your hand was up. Okay. Keep putting your hand up.
One of the big issues that we've asked the council to do is start identifying where we want this district to be. So, we need to know where that is. But in terms of the law itself, I've gone through it again. Two big things jumped out at me. One of them is not very major, but is that it envisions having a public works committee, which will do the annual review of a budget, establishing the budget and establishing the where it's, the schedule of improvements. The question is, do we want to codify a public works committee and put that into the charter so that there always is a public works committee? That'd be one way to do it. There's also no reason we couldn't just simply say the council would do it. And then you could create a group a sub-working group, a committee every year to do that. You know, that's a relatively simple thing. You can decide how you want to do that.
Right.
The bigger issue I came across, it really starts getting into the weeds on this.
Yeah, he froze again, Jeff.
This happens up here. And what it is, and I would really recommend that people dig into this, is that there's going to be a maintenance fee that will apply essentially to all properties. That's fine. You have to figure out what that's going to be. And then there was an additional square footage fee, which was based on the square footage of the property. And a frontage fee, based on the amount of street frontage. The problem is the law as drafted, as laid out, exempts a huge amount of your building from the frontage fee or the square footage fee.
Well, I thought that one applied quickly, Jeff, just if I may, that one applied the businesses. I thought we were doing the square footage and frontage for businesses and residents were being scaled in a different way than the businesses were.
You are.
And scoping in law.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. But what you're doing is you are covering businesses, but you are effectively excluding all single.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, you.
You're effectively excluding all single family, two family, and multi-unit buildings.
What?
How so?
Given the, because by the classification codes, you exempt from the square footage and frontage fees what you call the double low foot traffic lots, which are 280 and 281. Which are residential units and multifamily units. And then you're also excluding all two family and single family homes. And that's a large area of, you know, parts of the city.
They're excluded,
don't know in terms of,
they're excluded from paying the fee under the law?
Under everything but the maintenance fee, yes. As structured, that's what it is. And I don't know how you developed that or what the point was.
Well, I think the point was that there would be a flat fee for residential properties, and then there would be a different type of consideration for businesses given the amount of traffic that a business gets on a ground floor abutting a street. I think that's how Ithaca seems to do it, and that was the basis of the law. So you had a business fee and a residential fee, or a two-fee structure. I thought that's how we were working. Going forward, and Dominic might be able to chime in on that point as well.
Okay, I don't, you know, and I'll go back and look at the Ithaca one, but I think the Ithaca created more separate districts. I don't believe it was.
Well, back to your point about the district, given our size, since we're 2 square miles, they could have multiple districts. We could have just one special district, be it the entire city, right?
Yeah, but that's, yes. No, we did talk about it. We could do other districts and we could, you know, lose more of deciding where we were going to do this and not cover parts of the city that are not sidewalk now. And, you know, you don't expect to do that certainly in the foreseeable future.
Right. So but, I guess you're saying as it reads, you feel that the maintenance fee doesn't equate to the, it creates an, you're, God, how to say this? It's a capricious type of distinction that's happening here. Like, therefore, you're paying less.
Well, I'm not sure it's capricious. I was more concerned about you actually going to, you know, generate enough revenue. Now, if your maintenance fee, which applies to everyone,
you're frozen.
What? I'm sorry.
Dorothy?
Am I there again?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry. If you establish a relatively high maintenance. Sweet. or a substantial one, let's put it that way, more sufficient revenue stream. But if you are keeping it a more modest and trying to rely on your higher traffic ones, I don't know if you're going to cover enough and get enough revenue.
Well, that was the point of, if it's, I don't know what we, how we define high, but if you have, if there's an average feet maintenance fee.
And you have to deal with the ADA.
Right, exactly. But if you have an average maintenance fee over 2,000 residential properties, that's X. I mean, presumably that could generate a considerable amount of money if it, I don't know what we're saying is high or low here, right? And then if there's the scalable section that's for business, that's for businesses based on square footage and frontage, et cetera, then, I mean, I have to be refreshed on this as well, so I'm just operating under what my original assumptions were when we were working on this.
Well, and I think maybe what we need to do is, you know, talk with Rob and just trying to come up with some estimates of what these fees numbers are.
Maybe me, you, and Rob should have a meeting.
Sure.
Isn't the fee structure what has been pending to decide about this for the last 9 months or something or more?
No.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, it is. What is going on? Why can you not make progress on this?
I don't know what the hang-up is, but I basically, if we don't, Jeff, you mean that you think Rob has never given you what a reasonable fee would be for a maintenance fee for a residential property under the current law?
I haven't talked to him about that.
Okay, well, let's meet with Rob.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. We need to do that. And that hasn't been something we've talked about for a while. We've been talking more about where we want to include within the district.
Well, we'll definitely have to have we've talked about this, and we'll just reiterate those points for the public exemptions for people who have done, or a reasonable exemption period for people who have done already work that meets the standard of the sidewalk law. Places where there are not sidewalks now, don't have the same amount of foot traffic, if they're out wherever they are, we could envision a time when we might extend sidewalks out to those areas, et cetera, et cetera. But those points we'll get to. But let's get the fee thing going. I mean, we can meet with, when you're ready, I'm ASAP, I'd like to meet with Rob.
Okay.
I mean, if the legal committee, like, so we're meeting once a month, right? And so if we're going to, I mean, like, it is not acceptable that next month we come back here and again somebody says, well, we need to figure out the fee structure. And I guess we better talk to Rob Perry. Because I have heard this many times.
Okay.
Jeff?
Yeah, Dominic.
Just to be identified, the maintenance fee, just for clarification, has nothing to do with shovel removal or anything like that, just so it's clear, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right. I didn't want people to get confused.
Right. So there'll be, for the public, a yearly assessed fee that will be paid in by residences and by businesses that will go toward this general sidewalk program that then the city could bond against the value of the tolls, frontage of city sidewalks, so we could create an equitable repair mechanism for the very inconsistent state of city sidewalks that cause a real problem for people.
So, Jeff, I think on that earlier question, we want to go with the council proposal, you know.
Just refer to the council.
Yeah, don't codify a DPW.
Yeah, I think that's a good move, too.
Yeah. Okay, let's move onward. The three of you will meet to work on the fees. And the last topic is the inclusionary zoning.
And just keep in mind when you guys meet that we have people that are going through a housing crisis. We have people just to come up with an affordable price, basically.
That's the goal.
So.
Who would be
take in consideration, like who would
well, you know,
people with disabilities, senior citizens, things of all of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the goal would be hopefully just an affordable scale for a fee, and then also to remind people in general that a shared burden for sidewalk repair will be much less expensive for the average homeowner than it would be if under the current system, which is a tax lien, if we actually did it. So whatever fee we're going to land on, if it does seem, you know, we're just going to have to really explain it correctly that this is always going to be less expensive than the other option, which is could be quite heavy. So, but yeah, to your point, Tiffany, definitely we'll try to make it affordable.
And a reminder, Jeff, I'm correct in assuming this has to go to referendum, which won't be obviously this November, but the following November? Oh, you're muted.
I know, sorry. It's subject to a permissive referendum, not a mandatory referendum. People would have to petition for it. But depending on when we get this out and doing it, it would probably go into next year.
Okay.
And I have to double check on the permissive referendum rules. It has to be tied to a regular election date or it could be a special election. But it's subject to I forgot what the percentage is of people submitting a petition asking it to be subject to a referendum.
Got it. Okay. We have one question. We'll take that and then move on to the next topic. Margaret Morris.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so the question that I had when this all started was, why does the city not enforce the code that's already on the books and have property owners maintain their sidewalks? That would seem to me to be a simple solution.
I would say that currently it's, well, even from the enforcement side of it, that won't deal with just large sections of the city that just have insufficient sidewalks, where there are already sidewalks there, but they're just crumbling everywhere. So I think in general, if it's a larger program where you can identify bigger sections and attack it, the scale becomes cheaper. And then if you're just going around using code enforcement to put tax liens on property owners who aren't fixing their sidewalks, even, I don't even know what that would look like if we sped up the program to have that done. I just can't envision that it would happen in a very timely way. So although this feels slow and onerous, I mean, eventually, if we could get this off the ground, it could be just a regular period of construction that will bring all the city sidewalks up to a certain standard.
Thank you, John.
So when this started, I submitted documents from New York City and how they enforce the sidewalk maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the strategy is pretty straightforward. If pavement is out of compliance, the homeowner is notified, or the property owner, if the business is notified, then they can have the thing done, have it inspected, make sure that it meets code. They can use a contractor that the city has approved, or if they don't do it, the city comes in and fixes the sidewalk and sends them a bill.
Yeah, that's what ours is too, but that's, John spoke to that just now.
We're not doing it, and I don't know what whether or not we could even afford to do it within our own existing code enforcement structure or DPW, how things operate. That's a whole other conversation to be had, but we're just trying to envision a system based off another community, Ithaca, that is doing this and seems to be doing it with some success, that we could have a smaller scale version of that law here. And also in a community that has a lot of county buildings, not-for-profit businesses and organizations that don't currently pay in for services. And this is a way that you get a buy-in from everyone in the community, basically, to support public infrastructure. That's the goal.
Okay.
And it doesn't publish...
Thank you, Margaret.
It doesn't punish those who have done their... who have met the code.
Right. Thank you, Margaret.
And I guess, Margaret, I get what you're saying in theory, and I totally agree, but obviously it's not working because we're in the situation where we are. And I think this hopefully looks at the bigger picture that in 5 years, our city is going to look totally different in a conformed way, you know, where everyone's going to have it done, you know, section by section in a timely manner, where in 5 years, where right now it's bit pieced and it's not enforceable, whatever it is, obviously it's not happening. So I think the goal is here is to, you know, put it in a different realm and hopefully make it, you know, quicker in one regard, longevity wise.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So let's get back to our final topic, and that is inclusionary zoning. Jeff, anything to report? You're muted.
Oh, I know. Sorry. I know you're not going to be happy. I'm still trying to struggle through this and working with it and with a lot of the direction you gave me on this from the last meeting of what you wanted. I've been trying to struggle with it and trying to prioritize other work. We have a long way to go. I've talked to Michelle. I need to work with her some more on some of this. And it's, you know, it is not an easy thing to be doing. I've been doing some more research. I'm trying to find, the different ways of approaching it in terms of both the in-lieu structure and the mandatory for it. One thing I did notice, I was doing some more research, is 20% set aside seems to be a very high threshold and is not something that is normally recognized. It is, you know, just I noticed from some of the literature. So I mean, you know, we got to keep that in mind. And I still, you know, we've got to work to see, is this really something that's feasible to go through for the city and how does it work? And I think it's useful to have it with the legal committee here and get the sense from the broader council of how they want to proceed with this, if this is something that is, you know, worth the effort to try and develop something.
I just have to interrupt. Like, the council has initiated this effort and has been working on this for quite a long time. And, you know, the process by which the council decides how it wants to proceed with it is not with your seemingly possibly, I mean, I have begun to suspect that you don't like the idea and that is why you haven't been working on it over such an incredibly long time. Basically, for me, there's very little other way to understand the delay, shall we say. And so,
well, the problem is you don't decide it either unilaterally, Rebecca.
No, and John and I developed the concept of the inclusionary zoning after conversations with lots of other people in the city. And so John and I have been working on it for, I don't know, a year, something like that. And then we brought it forward in the legal committee, I believe. And I believe we had many conversations in the legal committee about inclusionary zoning. So this is not just a new, you know, this is not a something to be. So anyway, that's the process as I understand it, is that we have been through committee for quite a long time. And now there should be a draft being developed, which can be discussed in committee and which can be eventually voted on.
Tell them, Rebecca.
Well,
so I just want to say, Jeff and I did speak a little bit. I've been gathering a lot of data from developers, so I finally have the numbers. So I've been doing the feasibility analyses for different scenarios. So now that I have all those numbers, we can actually get into looking at the feasibility of the different types of ordinances. So then
Great. We
can work on that draft for next time.
That's great, Michelle. Yeah, I'll hook up with you on this and get your hat and we can take it further. That's good.
Okay. That's a bit of an hour and a half. Unless there's any other matter you'd like to raise.
I guess I would just like to figure out if we need to have a schedule of some kind to keep this moving forward and keep it on track. Like, do there need to be milestones put in place? Like, by such and such a day, you will have done such and such a thing. You know, that seems to be, like, I'm not clear on how many hours a week you are officially Hudson City Council and what you're, you know, what you're doing during those hours.
Rebecca, I think this is a discussion best held offline. I don't really think we should be, I mean, I'm not.
I agree.
Yeah. I don't think we should be. I mean, it's important. Yeah. I agree that you can ask this.
On Rebecca's behalf, you know, I feel her frustration, and it's not just something that she feels and notices, is something that our constituents constantly bring to our attention. So I support her on this. And yes, if you discuss it online, I would like to hear the results of this conversation to see where it goes. But I support our minority leader.
Okay. So barring that, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Right, Tom?
Yes, Dominic.
Can we just put on the table the speed limit, you know, moving that for Glenwood, you know, so it's on the radar, you know, because, you know, it's been out there and changed a little bit. And I don't know, Jeff, maybe you don't like, you know, speed. No, I'm just kidding. you know, but and I just think that whatever, with all the changes coming down Glenwood, and it's definitely an issue, I think trying to figure out how we can reduce that to 25 miles an hour.
Yes.
And I know that it's a process, Jeff, and I appreciate you joining me with the process and understand and the length of it. And I just want to say I'm uncomfortable with the attack Rebecca just made to Jeff. I mean, you know, a lot of these things are nuanced, takes a long time, and being patient, unfortunately, is part of it, you know, and as you know, I have a lot of initiatives that are still, you know, working through, but I don't think attacking certain things on is productive.
Yeah. Thank you, Dominic. And I agree. And I think that we'll end right there so that we don't get further into it.
Well, let me just answer, Dominic, your question. In terms of the linear speed limits for the roads, Dominic, all I need is a list or description of the streets you want covered.
Okay. Basically, right now, to start with, you know, I'll definitely get it to you, but I think it's just going to be Glenwood right now to start with, so we can have a template to see where that goes, because that's a high issue now they're cutting through. So, you know, we can talk on that, Jeff.
Okay, because I think it's like, you know, since we're not trying to do the citywide thing, it's a relatively straightforward.
Awesome. Thanks,
Matt. Great. A motion to adjourn.
I make that motion.
Dominic seconds. All in favor, say aye. There we go. Okay, thank you all. This has been
a
very productive meeting. See you next Tuesday. Monday. I'm sorry.
Monday the 13th.
Monday the 13th.
And are we doing that in person or how?
We're going to try to a hybrid. The only people who will be in person are council members who want to be in person. No, none of the public will be allowed in person. But we will have the OWL system in play. So, and it'll be the debut of our new hybrid system.
I think given my connection issues, I think I'll plan on being there.
Okay, great. Thank you all. Good night.
Thanks. Da-dum-dum.